Cowboys are back. Movie fans have ponied up over $100 million so far to see the Coen brothers' True Grit. Earlier this week, a member of the All Things Considered staff made this embarrassed confession during our morning editorial meeting. He said he had seen True Grit and was surprised to find that he liked it. Surprised because, as he admitted, he didn't think he liked Westerns. Needless to say, he grew up in a post-Gunsmoke, post-Rawhide, and post-Bonanza decade, and we reckoned that he wasn't alone. So for those of you who roll your eyes at the thought of a drunken saloon brawl or a ride into the sunset, we have invited Bob Mondello, our movie critic, to give us a little starter kit for the multiplex tenderfoot. Howdy, Bob.
Howdy.
Let's start with some basics. What makes a Western a Western?
Well, white hats, black hats, guns, frontier codes of honor, big sky country, I guess.
There are a lot of Westerns that have been made, and we asked you to pick a few. Let's start with the earliest pick on your list. It's from 1953, Shane.
I've heard about you. What have you heard, Shane?
I've heard that you're a low-down Yankee liar.
Now, this is a classic Western. You've got a good guy, Alan Ladd, and the bad guy there was Jack Palance. And it's about being pure in the way that America was pure. It's about the going out there, and it's the frontier, and you're going to make everything right somehow.
Now, a starter kit wouldn't be complete without at least one movie from the director who single-handedly built the Western from the ground up, John Ford, and his favorite star, John Wayne. But the film that you've picked, which was released just 3 years after Shane, is not typical of Ford, Wayne, or the genre. Tell us about the movie The Searchers.
Right. The Searchers is complicated. It's about something more than just good and bad. The good guy, John Wayne, is an unrepentant racist in this. He hates the Comanches. And it's very much about how the settlers treated the Native Americans in that period. It's a very complicated, gorgeous, epic Western.
It's about gray hats.
That's exactly right.
For the next pick, Bob, one which rewrote the rules of the Western a bit, and which can be summed up in one quick line.
If they move, kill them.
It's actor William Holden, the ringleader of The Wild Bunch by director Sam Peckinpah. Why The Wild Bunch?
Well, if the Western can be about something in the Wild West, it can be about other things too. And Peckinpah decided to make this picture about violence. It is much more violent than the previous pictures. A lot of blood on screen, a lot of slow motion violence. And he intended that as a comment on Vietnam. This came out in 1969, and so he meant this to be about other social issues, not just the ones from the Wild West.
And it was that vivid violence that turned off a lot of people, but that changed the rules of making a Western.
Absolutely.
You would say. On your list, proving that you're not too predictable, you've added a comedy, one of my favorites, Mel Brooks's Blazing Saddles. And this is not John Ford's Western.
How about some more beans, Mr. Taggart?
I'd say you've had enough.
I'd say it had enough, too. They'd all had enough. That's the campfire scene from Blazing Saddles. I should warn people that this is definitely rated R. The subject matter and the language tend to be pretty adventuresome for the age, but it was a very, very funny picture.
And finally, no list would be complete without at least one film from Clint Eastwood. Which one did you pick?
Oh, no, this was hard because you want to pick one of the spaghetti westerns, but I finally decided that I had to pick something from a little later. It's as if the Western stopped coming out in 1970, so I picked Unforgiven.
I thought they was going to get us. I was even scared a little, just for a minute. Was you ever scared in them days?
I can't remember. I was drunk most of the time.
It is a magnificent Western from 1992, really epic. It's about the old outlaws. This is the end of the era. A lot of people thought, actually, that it was a sort of a eulogy for the form. It ended up not being a eulogy for the form because they made a whole lot of other pictures after it. It sort of inspired a Western revival.
That's a very interesting list you've compiled.
And it's by no means complete, and I know that. I mean, this is five pictures. I've got about 20 on our website, npr.org. If you go there, you can maybe somebody could give us their own starter kit for people who don't like Westerns. I think if you look at these five pictures, though, and you still don't see anything you like, you really don't like Westerns.
Okay. Bob Mondello, thanks for providing us with a starter kit for liking Westerns.
Always a pleasure.
He rode a blazing saddle. He wore a shining star. His job to offer battle.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. Now we're going to discuss some of the practical and ethical questions raised by this degree of genetic screening. I spoke earlier today with Dr. Jeffrey Botkin. He's a bioethicist and professor of genetics and pediatrics at the University of Utah. He says the test poses challenges for would-be parents who find they are both carriers of the same genetic mutations.
So the initial question would be how to deal with this information as it flows. And one of the things that is always a concern from an ethical perspective is making sure people accurately understand that information. We have a history from the 1970s in which sickle cell screening was conducted in the population, and there was quite a bit of misunderstanding about carrier status. People misunderstand that terminology. They may think that they have the disease, and that may create problems with their own emotional reaction as well as the possibility of discrimination.
Within the framework of the information that's already available, through testing, in your experience, what do couples who discover an increased risk of having a child with a genetic disease generally do with that information? What kinds of options are available to them?
Of course, for couples who find that they are at risk prior to pregnancy, they have a large number of choices. Adoption might well be a choice. Egg donation or sperm donation would be a choice. They may choose to proceed with becoming pregnant and then evaluate that pregnancy for whether the fetus is affected, and if so, then make a decision about whether to terminate that pregnancy or not. If testing is conducted once pregnancy has begun, then, of course, the choices are much more limited.
Now, some people are already saying this should raise alarms because it could lead to more abortions. It could lead to the stigmatization of certain diseases or parents who are carriers for these diseases. On the other side, could you also argue that this perhaps could lead parents to better prepare for a child that might have special needs?
Oh, absolutely. And I think that that would be a logical flow of information to folks who'd want to make decisions, understanding that the child was going to be affected, about how best to care for that child, perhaps what hospital would be best to deliver that child, and to make sure that the appropriate experts were on hand to help deal with the nature of that condition.
Are doctors prepared to handle these kinds of discussions?
I would say physicians are not prepared to handle this type of discussion at this point. And what the literature tends to show is that there's less than ideal level of conversation around the carrier testing and prenatal testing that is already available.
Parents hope and pray for healthy children, and they might do whatever they can to ensure that that happens. I'm just wondering if this moves the country potentially into a very uncomfortable zone. You've been talking about genetics, but on a societal level, does this raise the whole question of eugenics?
Well, it certainly does to some extent. And I think the focus of this paper is on serious childhood conditions. And that's the sort of testing that's been less controversial than other sorts of testing or other sorts of reasons to terminate a pregnancy. But we would have to wonder whether opening the door to this volume of testing might then invite next steps, which would be testing for conditions that were less severe or potentially for traits that really were not health-related traits at all.
Dr. Jeffrey Botkin, thank you very much.
Thank you, Michelle.
Dr. Jeffrey Botkin is a pediatrician and a bioethicist at the University of Utah. This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Robert Siegel. Alaska is a magnificent place full of natural beauty. It's also a vast, unforgiving landscape full of places where humans can find themselves isolated and lonely. In short, it is the perfect setting for a novel. Alan Chews has this review of Caribou Island from writer David Vann.
The first fall storm, blasts of wind and rain, a 30-degree drop in temperature, the sky gone dark, a malevolence, a beast physical and intent. Here in David Vann's Alaska, everything's growing colder by the day, by the hour. At the center of this turbulent story about the disintegration and death of love stands an isolated island in the center of a large Alaskan lake. Here, as the season turns toward winter, a husband and wife, Gary and Irene, have hauled logs from the far shore to build a cabin, a shelter for the rest of their lives, or so Gary sees it. An emotionally isolated scholar of Old English who came to Alaska with Irene decades ago, this bitter-minded husband recites ancient epics into the rising wind while hammering logs together badly to make this island home. He's a dark soul, a champion of regret, the novelist calls him. Irene has a troubled mind. As a young girl, she came home from school to find her mother hanging by the neck, and that dark image became the signature of the rest of her life. The remorse of her Alaskan exile and the way it cuts into the last days of her marriage becomes the main narrative line of this novel. Despite multiple storylines, which, like those logs Gary hauls out to the island for his cabin, appear somewhat badly nailed together, Caribou Island builds to an horrific climax and stands as an engrossing and disturbing work of art.
David Vann is the author of Caribou Island. Alan Chews teaches writing at George Mason University in Fairfax, Virginia.
Now a case of faith and zoning. In Hartford, Connecticut, an Orthodox Jewish group wants to run a religious center for nearby university students. Neighbors don't want it there, and the city wants it shut down. As Jeff Cohen from member station WNPR reports, the argument could be decided by a relatively new federal law, one that offers some protection for religious groups.
Bloomfield Avenue is studded by huge homes from the early 1900s and beyond. It's also a busy street linking the city of Hartford with its suburban neighbors, and a few steps from here are a private school, a Unitarian church, the University of Hartford, and this new neighbor, a Chabad house, a place for Jewish university students to pray, celebrate, and learn. Rabbi Yosef Kulik says he doesn't want to be disruptive.
I would estimate that this neighbor is about 75, 100 feet away, give or take. I would think that whatever happens, whatever we do, I think we are good, quiet neighbors.
Not if you ask the neighbors. Kathleen Sullivan and her husband don't want to be next to a student center, Jewish or otherwise. It doesn't have to be Animal House to be a problem. Sullivan says even the infrequent run-of-the-mill college student gatherings stick out in a residential neighborhood.
They're kids. There's a lot of noise. There's a lot of singing and dancing and screaming, and that's a big change from what we're used to.
They and neighbor Stu Cooper also don't like the suggestion that to be against the Chabad House is to be against Jews.
I am Jewish. And I am certainly not anti-Semitic. And this is strictly a zoning issue. It is not a religious issue.
But it's a legal issue. The city of Hartford says local zoning doesn't permit the Chabad house, and the case is in federal court, where Chabad is arguing that the city wants to keep it out because of its religion. To do that, Chabad is using a 10-year-old federal law called the Religious Land Use and Institutionalized Persons Act. The law was designed to overcome religious discrimination in local zoning. Mark Stern is Associate General Counsel for American Jewish Committee. He helped write the law and says it's been useful for small, less established religious groups moving into old, well-established communities.
It's why Lubavitcher Chabad is so often in court, why Pentecostalist churches are so often in court, because these are relatively new churches on the American scene and certainly in the suburbs. And it's they who are trying to break the status quo, and they who are excluded by the zoning laws, not the churches who've been there for 150 years.
And Stern says the law has worked, making it easier for houses of worship to open where they weren't before. But Marcy Hamilton says the law ignores the concerns of neighbors who don't want to live next to a church or a church dance hall or anything like them. Hamilton teaches at the Cardozo School of Law.
It never occurred to anybody in the process that homeowners were going to get slammed by inappropriate uses next door to their homes.
And she says this creates real animosity.
Because the homeowners will repeatedly say, we are not objecting because of your religion, we're objecting because of your dance hall. And the religious group comes back and says, but this is our religious mission.
We see our mission is to educate our youth about their heritage, about their religion, about Jewish philosophy.
Chabad leader Rabbi Joseph Gopin says to do that means being near the university students it serves. As for the federal law that prohibits religious discrimination in local zoning, it has survived numerous challenges in court. For NPR News, I'm Jeff Cohen in Hartford.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News.